Joining us now is author Michael Paternity. His story describing the dangerous escape of 8 North Korean teenagers to South Korea and their adjustment to life there is in this week's cover story in the New York Times Magazine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
The title of your piece is The Flight of the Fluttering Swallows. Tell us what that means.
The Fluttering Swallows, actually, it comes from a Russian term that meant nomads, and then the Chinese interpretation, kochebi, is translated in Korean as fluttering swallows. It's complicated, but the final translation is fluttering swallows. This is a group of primarily parentless minors, children who have fled North Korea, often along that northern border between North Korea and China, and often by crossing the Tumen River, quite a dangerous crossing up there. Estimates have it that about 10,000 of these children have made this trip into the southern part of the Jilin province of China. And from there, a very lucky few end up on these underground railroads that basically usher these refugees out of China into third countries that are able then to transport the refugees on to South Korea, including Mongolia, Thailand, and Burma.
Tell us a little bit about what these journeys are like. What happens to these
young people? They are children who've been, mostly teenagers, mostly 16, between 16 and 20 year-olds who have been steeped in a military authoritative culture that has regimented every part of their social lives. They've grown up under a communist regime. They've glorified the great leader and the dear leader, Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, and suddenly have landed in Oz. They've landed in South Korea, which is itself is in the throes of hyper-capitalism. They're given money by the South Korean government, in fact, a great deal of money during their first 2 years in the country. They're subsidized to, I think, the tune of about $25,000 to $35,000. They have no real concept of what money is, so they spend wildly. They study the South Korean teenagers. They study their fashion. They study their music and their films. They are just wide-eyed babes in Disneyland.
Mm-hmm. You actually spent 2 weeks living with these young adults, seven boys and one girl in a house in Seoul.
Yes.
Tell us some of their individual stories.
I was moved by each one of these kids. They each had made dramatic escapes from North Korea. In the case of one boy, he'd been literally caught 17 times. He lived in the streets and video parlors in China, was beaten severely. I'd say more than half of these fluttering swallows had been beaten severely, had been caught by either North Korean agents or Chinese authorities. In the case of one boy, Hyo, he was able to cross into China with his mother, and at one point it became too dangerous for him to stay with his mother. The Chinese authorities actually give rewards to Chinese citizens to turn in North Korean refugees. And so they split up, and Hyo ended up being taken in by a religious organization, a South Korean religious group working in China, and they were trained down to Beijing, a group of 8 refugees, and they charged the South Korean consulate. And Hyo told me this story when I was there just 6 or 7 weeks ago, and told it as if it was yesterday. It was actually last September that they made their charge on the consulate. They were able to get through the first gate and then charge the guards at the second gate and were punching and fighting their way into the consulate. When they finally thought that they could go no further, that in fact the attempt had failed, the South Korean consul came out and said, told the Chinese guards to back off, that, mm-hmm. that they were now officially in South Korea on South Korean property. Mm-hmm. And so they spent a month there and were moved, I think, through the Philippines and then on to Seoul. Mm-hmm. But in each case, these fluttering swallows have spent, you know, anywhere from 5 years to 5 months in the journey it's taken them from North Korea to South Korea.
Mm-hmm. We want to tell our listeners to give us a call if you have a question about life in North Korea and what it's like to leave the North try to adapt to the South. Our number is 1-800-989-TALK. That's 1-800-989-8255. Any other particular stories that moved you as you lived with these young people in this house in Seoul?
Yeah, well, one of the things that really moved me was the fact that this group of eight fluttering swallows and this larger group of North Korean refugees who now make their home in South Korea. Last year there were 1,200 refugees total that were able to make it to South Korea. All of them are marked by starvation. I mean, the fact that they are malnourished. They're mm-hmm. shorter than the average South Koreans. They speak a dialect that South Koreans don't understand. And the physical shape of their heads their heads end up being oversized for their body. And this is something that a couple of anthropologists in particular who I spent some time with pointed to as scarring differences that has led to subtle discrimination and not so subtle discrimination against these North Korean refugees. Mm-hmm. And looking at these children, watching them struggling to embrace this culture that is completely foreign to them, I was filled every day with premonitions of what their future may hold. And what their future may hold are low-paying jobs. Oftentimes they're unable to hold jobs for long periods of time because in South Korea there are certain demands. There's a certain spirit of competition that is utterly alien to the North Korean refugees. Mm-hmm. And they often are humiliated, and saving face and keeping face are such huge elements of the culture that if they are humiliated in their work, they just don't return. Mm-hmm. So they drop out. They suffer depression, suicide, all sorts of other social problems, and they are not certain how to actually deal with these things because there's no support group for them.
Just a moment. I need to say you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News, and let's go to a caller, Scott in Boston. Scott, you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, hi, guys. Interesting show. I think to me that American culture or Western culture or foreign cultures, as they infiltrate through Internet and TV and radio and other forms, are often a big catalyst for change in more closed societies. How is it that North Korea and China, if you know, keeps those kind of cultural influences out? And how is it that they wind up getting in anyway, if they do?
Mm-hmm. Good question, Scott. What did you learn from these young people from North Korea? Did they have any sense of what they were in for as they came out of North Korea, Michael?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And one of the things that just continued to surprise me in conversation with the fluttering swallows was their basic naivete about Western culture. One of the women in the house at one point turned to me and asked, is it true that every American house has a robot?
Hmm.
So what they had been able to glean in North Korea about the world beyond came in these little fairy tales and these little bits of misinformation and disinformation the actual, you know, idea that Nike swoosh actually means something to them. I mean, it is actually a symbol of a corporation.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it was lost on them. They have no idea what these signs and symbols mean.
Mm-hmm.
Though, once out of North Korea and once especially into South Korea, they begin to realize that a lot of what they learned, a lot of the propaganda films they saw in school about the evil American imperialists, they were propagandized, and so they had a lot of questions for me in particular about American culture. And at one point, one of them asked, "Is it true that the very, very wealthy in America make $35,000 a year every year?" Their concept of money, of course, was only based on what they could buy with the money they had in their hand. So they had no real sense of that either, though clearly they were immediately were absorbing the video games and the movies.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller, Gary in Jacksonville, Florida. Hello, Gary.
Hello.
Hi, Gary.
Hi. You mentioned that they were rescued by a religious group. And it seemed odd that you did not mention which religious group or order or was it Christians, was it Buddhists? I think that's an important piece of information. I'm curious why you didn't mention it.
Well, let's just ask Michael whether he left it out intentionally or who the religious group was or whether it matters.
Well, I mean, I can certainly say that there are Christian religious groups and Buddhist groups working in China right now, establishing safe houses, trying to find safe passage for these refugees. But yeah, to name the groups certainly puts them at risk and jeopardizes not only the integrity of these underground railroads that they've established, but also jeopardizes the people in China working right now on behalf of the refugees.
Mm-hmm. In your article, you reflect on the exposure of these young people to violence and how that affects them. Tell us about how they view violence now.
Well, the culture that they grew up in glorifies the military, and they had all had a certain amount of training in school with shooting guns. They'd done some tunnel training where they actually, as part of their curriculum, went down into tunnels and lived for a while. And they seem to have a very well-versed sense of firearms. In fact, we ended up at one point at an amusement park, and there was a live shooting gallery down in the basement of this extravaganza, this four-story indoor amusement park. And they went and picked out, you know, the actual weapons that they had fired in North Korea and felt comfortable firing. That violence to them was very familiar. As startling as it was to me, to them it was very familiar. Mm. And I think one of the great concerns right now for those working with the fluttering swallows is that these teenagers are going to end up falling into North Korean motorcycle gangs, which are on the rise in South Korea. And as sort of a parable, one person told me the tale of a fluttering swallow who had recently died in a motorcycle accident after drinking heavily.
Thanks for speaking with us this afternoon.
Thank
Michael
you.
Paternity wrote this week's cover story for the New York Times Magazine. It's called The Flight of the Fluttering Swallows. He spoke to us from his office in Portland, Maine. In Washington, I'm John Itzde for NPR News.